Okay, we're going to take your phone calls with David Paris as we talk about Space War right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, David Paris with us. David, you're still involved with MUFON in the Nebraska area, aren't you?
Yes, I'm the Douglas County section director.
Tell me about your interest with that.
Well, it really kind of stems back from the original sighting that I had. Have had an interest in unidentified flying objects, and so as I had a lot of birthdays, I got kind of interested.
You're still counting them, huh?
Still counting them. Maybe not celebrating them as often, but still counting them. I became a STAR team member of our sanction organization here in the state of Nebraska. And we don't get as many sightings as there are around in the other parts of the country, but we do have some interesting ones. Of course, you have the lights in the sky, which are, they're not very exciting because there's not a lot of definition or details that come with these things.
Well, you know what, I tell Tom, too, when we do open lines, I say, look, you know, I want really riveting UFO stories, but not lights in the sky, because everybody sees lights in the sky.
We get a lot of that, and particularly around 4th of July, there's been a lot of the Chinese lanterns that people launch off and get of an array of reports.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
And we try to, we'll call the people once they enter this up into the database for the MUFON, and then we're assigned the cases, and then we go out and we'll either call on the phone or physically go out. Now, we've had some interesting, several interesting sightings where there were squirrels on the ground left by a craft that came over. We went and took soil samples, did radiation measurements, and that we found increases in radiation in the soil. Trying to again look at the evidence and let the data lead us to a conclusion. But unfortunately, because usually this is after the fact and we haven't seen it ourselves, or there's no photographic evidence and other pieces of evidence, you know, you're left with just kind of little scraps of it, and many times it just leads you to an unknown. So out of the hundreds or thousands of cases, it's like that tiny percentage, like a 0.5% or 1%, that may have all the proper ingredients that which everybody's always looking for is the smoking gun.
Sure.
And that's what I'm looking for. I'm heavily interested in propulsion. So other ideas and little characteristics that can be related as a result of these observations, you know, may help me come up with some additional ideas. I don't, you know, it's like anything. I've got 8 models of this motor. So the evolution over 2.5 years has been that great. And one just 2 months ago, and that's already obsolete in my mind, and we're already on to the next one. So, you know,
How fast can you travel in space if you're in a space warp?
Depending upon power, and kind of give you an idea, we have, again, some charts, but we're using the same specific impulses that NASA uses with their Dawn spacecraft, for example. They use 666 watts, which they generate 91 millinewtons, which is a very small, tiny amount. But this is a cumulative thing over time. And over a 1,700-day period of time, they've achieved 26,700 miles per hour using the same criteria. And by the way, that is the fastest craft that humans have ever designed. Total thrust, no gravity assist, coming towards Jupiter and then pulling the craft a little bit faster. With ours, utilizing the same the same criteria, the specific impulse, we use 100 watts of power, which is basically 5% of the total amount of power available on that craft, and we generate in 52 minutes 10 newtons, and over a 1,780-day period of time, our estimates are that we would travel 3 million miles an hour. Now,
wow.
In space,
that's not fast still.
It's relatively fast in the sense that you could get places a whole lot faster than what we're doing right now.
Well, probably in our solar system, I guess.
But yes, easily enough. And we've made some estimates based on, again, the lower level power of these motors now and extrapolating those out. And, you know, our estimates are somewhere about 250,000 watts of power should get us to about the speed of light. And that the increments that the breakpoints of these things are, and that's the equivalent of like, you know, if you got a really big radio station, 100,000 watts of power out of the antennas, and you're broadcasting all over. But when you confine and concentrate this, it means you're actually compressing that fabric of space in front of the craft, and as you traverse in a linear progression. So it's a different thought process than velocity and acceleration, is because you're actually manipulating distance by, I guess if you wanted to look at taking a carpet and, like a throw rug and scrunching it up. The throw rug is still there, but when you scrunch it up, you just have to step over it, right?
You got that. Let's go to the phones. We'll go to Davie, Florida. First of all, Jeffrey's with us on the wild card line. Jeffrey, good to have you with us.
Good morning. How are you all doing there?
Good.
Good. I wanted to ask, now you say this is nonlinear, this compression and advancement in travel or whatever. So, in other words, could you, if you're traveling in a flying in a column like that, and then this occurs, could you be projected off course, say 20, 50 degrees or whatever, or maybe even sent back, you know, reversed back to where you were, whatever, an hour ago?
Well, the motor pretty much will move in the direction that you point it. So from that aspect, it would be pretty controlled. Mm-hmm. The outside influences would be in space, for example, would be the influence of the planets or the sun or a star, and depending upon how far you project it. So, I mean, there's going to be some computations here one has to make to effectively create a straight navigable course, but you have to consider these other factors that go into it. Now, the other part of this is that, you know, we've not done that yet. I mean, this is highly speculative on our part, but just kind of taking into consideration all the knowledge that we have right now about it, this is kind of like where we're headed with that. And there's still more exploration to be done. And you're not going to see the Starship Enterprise out there yet. You know, we're making small advances here. And eventually, as we develop the bigger motors with more power, we hope to, from a terrestrial basis, move things around here on the Earth. I mean, if you can just imagine the kind of cost factors in lifting a pound of materials to space. Right now, estimates between 30 to 50,000 from the past to, I've seen as low as $10,000 per pound. We may be down into the area of just maybe $10 a pound, which would definitely revolutionize the economy, a space-based economy or spacefaring nation.
Let's go to George in Tucson, Arizona, west of the Rockies. George, you're up with us. Go ahead.
How do you do? My name is George. I've been listening to your show and hearing about time and time warp in space.
Mm-hmm.
I believe there's a future time in our universe that we can't see. Our sun is giving off a light that's traveling at 186,000 miles a second through our solar system, leaving our galaxy and traveling through the universe. So at that speed, it must be received by some future time in the universe that we can't see. There's an actual future in the universe that we can't see. And we couldn't even get to it in a spaceship unless we were traveling at the speed of light along with our sunlight. But I believe there is a part of the universe that's a future time. And we could see throughout our universe through our sophisticated telescopes. And everything we see is in the now, but we really can't see the future. But I believe there's a future time in the universe. And also, the gentleman speaking about spacecraft, I don't believe that we're alone in the universe. I believe that there are others in the universe. They probably don't look like us, but I don't believe we were the only ones that were made in the entire universe. When we speak of the universe, we're speaking of an infinite amount of space that is forever. And I can't imagine that we're the only ones existing in this forever space that we're existing in. I don't believe that.
Well, we agree with you, George. I don't think we are the only ones out here. David, I'm sure you agree, too.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in the universe, you got over 320 billion galaxies, and our own galaxy has over 500 billion stars in it. All that's been updated here very recently. And statistics with the Drake equation puts us out into hundreds of thousands of potential civilizations that might be close to us as in the case of development or advanced of us. That's being very conservative, but I've seen estimates as high as 14 million within our own galaxy. So I believe along with you is that we're not the only ones here. And the crap that we see, I really don't believe that they're produced here onto the Earth. Now, if they are, okay. It'd be nice to know that so we could eliminate a lot of this paperwork.
I think you're accidentally building a time machine, though, David.
Oh, I don't know about that, but I can tell you, though, it was a little humbling, I guess, to start running some numbers on going faster than light, because this doesn't violate relativity here. We're literally scooping up space. We're scrunching up the fabric of space so that we can cross it at a quicker rate. But there's been estimates that perhaps maybe the upper limit of this is 1,000 times faster than light. Now, you know, we're still in a test cell, okay? So I would love to be able to get a craft out there in space and really soup it up with the turbocharger and all this kind of stuff, you know, to make it go faster. But we're not quite there yet. But the fact that we have something that actually can demonstrate the compression of the fabric of space is just by itself truly remarkable. But I'm not satisfied with that. I do want to see lifting this craft off the ground of the 50 pounds. And to get that up and off the ground, because at that point, there isn't any more discussion about can it do it, is this true or not true, and we're kind of held to a second standard or a higher standard, because we are an independent, self-funded research organization, and hopefully that in the future here that we will actually manufacture these motors, and that's why Space Warp Dynamics, but the original cast and crew, so to speak, as an assembly of people who are very interested in this endeavor. For example, like Matt Judah, for example, he's our resident physics guru, and he's out in Fort Collins getting his PhD in physics. So we'll be we communicate readily back and forth, phone and everything else, and we bounce ideas off of each other and that. And he and I are the main guys in developing these things. I do all the hardware, and he writes equations, I write equations. We go back and forth on all this stuff, and it's a great companionship there of knowledge. And then we have other members that do the IT. We have a test pilot. We have flight dynamics controls, and we're developing the cockpit controls for an actual manned craft. And so we have to be able to... everything coincides with the future development of an actual seven-passenger craft. That's our ultimate goal, and right now is the UAV. Now, getting back to, I believe that gentleman's name was George.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking about future time. Well, actually, the star's light that we see is back time. It's taken so many billions of years for that light to get here. And that was my other comment that I was going to make, is that when you start looking at how fast you could potentially go, and since the galaxy that we have is over 200,000 light years wide, and it's about 1,500 light years thick, We're about into the middle of that thickness, and if we were to penetrate out to from the galaxy, it would take at 1,000 times the speed of light. It would take us about 9.5 months to get there, outside, just getting outside of the thickness of the galaxy, and then to come back, about a year and a, you know, about almost 2 years of travel, and that's going full bore. It's a humbling experience from the standpoint is that we're going to be contained in our Milky Way galaxy.
Let's go to Joey, truck driving in Texas now. Joey, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. Great show, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Hey, David, really interesting topic, and I wish you all the success in the future, man. I hope your guys are really successful, and I hope things get going really good. I just had a quick question, man, and I'll take my comment off air. I'm sure over the years, if nothing more for just pure curiosity, I'm sure you've seen the Bob Lazar tapes, reports, or whatnot that he's produced, what he was able to determine with how these craft, you know, and their propulsion systems work. And, again, I just was curious if you're finding the same things that he would have found, or does he look like he was on point, or is these craft possibly have, you know, the same things? They got. I'm just really curious about that, about what maybe thought about Lazar and what he showed on his proposal reports. Anyway, thanks, guys. Appreciate it, George.
You got it.
Thanks, Joey. The motor structures that he was looking at were these anti-gravity. They are three-position movements on these motors to create a like a bubble. Now, whether it was a warp bubble or not, it's not to say is that other craft can't do other things in space itself. All I can really address, if what he says is true, then I would have loved to have seen that myself and to go out and touch it, look at it, and all this. But I can only address what I've seen and what I've been able to develop along with Matt and the other guys of this particular motor. I know this doesn't really answer your question, but I really don't like to speculate way out of bounds when I don't have the information or data.
How did you even get to the point where you invented this?
Oh, this is like a massive detective story. I mean, this is the thing, you know, I've got the hair raising up on my arm here. I mean, to think back from 16 years old all the way to present, all the multidiscipline background that I have in engineering and physics and astronomy, and, you know, you read them all off in the beginning of the show. It was because I had that experience in particularly in meteorology as a numerical weather modeler and a forecaster observer. I worked radar, did upper air. I did everything in the weather field. And the fact that understanding, well, and I also teach meteorology, but the fact, the key here was Bruce's explanation and his, you know, which he relates into his book, The Fog. When you analyze what happened to him, it kind of hit me like a ton of bricks. Here we were trying to recreate situations of forecasting and sending a craft back into this, which would be extremely dangerous. But then it dawned on me, hey, create these fields and bring them into the lab and reproduce it.
Let's find out. David, hold on for a sec. We'll be back with more on Coast to Coast AM. David Paris with us. We're going to take more of your phone calls next hour with David as well here on Coast to Coast AM. But when we come back, let's finish up this hour and then we'll go to the next. And welcome back, David Paris with us. David, so you were commenting on how you invented this. I'll let you pick it up from there.
Yeah, you know, as I said, just kind of do a quick recap of with Bruce's flight and the realization as it was the thunderstorm fields, these what they refer to as a tripole field. And again, in the world of science, we have lots of controversy, even in meteorology. Earl Wilson in 1983 proposed these tripole field structures within thunderstorms, where most people have always accepted it was just like a big, huge dipole, plus at the top, minus at the bottom. But what he was trying to relate was the fact that you had a plus-minus dipole in the top of the cloud and a minus-plus dipole at the bottom, and that represents as a tripole field. So it's a little bit different. But over the years, other scientists and a group of meteorologists in India actually took tremendous amounts of upper air data, and they analyzed it all, and they came up with the conclusion that, indeed, that thunderstorms had a tripole field, electric field within the thunderstorm. And this was a huge revelation, because this is what led us to trying to replicate what happened to Bruce in the lab. But from a practical standpoint, how would you actually implement something like this? And my thoughts went in this kind of progression of, well, what if we had two big, huge tripole antennas that we stuck out and we flew an airplane between and put all kinds of energy there, and then poof, the plane goes downrange. But how do you control that? I mean, would it go 50 miles, 2 feet, 100 miles, 300 miles? And then you're left out in the middle of nowhere to finish your mission or your flight. And so that wasn't really a practical application of this. And this is where we started to think about miniaturizing and creating an engine that utilized these tripole fields and putting multiple tripole fields, engaging them onto into the motor to create this high compression field that, you know, adjusts the fabric of space. And that's kind of like the evolution of this thing. And that's why we have 8 different models of it. From the, again, if you go to the website, there's a lot of great pictures on there of the initial arrays that we used with an interferometer and that we built. I mean, this is a real low-budget kind of stuff. I have to emphasize that. There's no real fancy equipment here. It all works, and it's all adaptable from, it's been what I refer to as adaptive engineering. So we take stuff that wasn't designed to do this, but we turn it into what we need, and we have our electrical engineer, and he produces the different circuits for us that we need, and then, you know, we integrate all the stuff back together, and so it's an ever-evolving process here, but it's really kind of interesting to see the beginning photographs to where we were about a year ago to where we are right now with the design of the latest motor. And one another future one is coming out here in just a few weeks that I was able to, from this last engine, was to double its output with the same input. Good. So we went from a 2 millimeter per 30-second pull to on a vertical spring scale to a 4 millimeter pull in 30 seconds.
When do you think this could be put into practical use?
Given the right funding. And this is our next step. We want to go to like an Indiegogo crowdfunding source, and we feel that if we had about $100,000 or so, we could make this craft fly off the ground, and that would give us the power supplies that we need and all the proper electronics, because all this stuff is custom. It's you just don't go to your local store.
Don't go to Radio Shack and pick up the pieces.
Yeah, you don't go down to Walmart and say, hey, you know, I need a warp drive, please.
Yeah.
Can I have a power supply?
Please.
How about that string of batteries over there on the wall? Now, I do admit, for the torsion balance that we designed, we used, believe it or not, some chrome-plated ball hitches, and we bolted those together and balanced them. And it turns out to be that they were 3.5 pounds. Hmm. And so we're not afraid and we're not proud of adapting things. We don't need everything custom made. And we're very resourceful. We can really stretch a dollar. And in my position, working all these jobs, you got to.
You got to do it. Let's go to George in Apollo, Pennsylvania. George, welcome to the show. Go ahead.
Yes, Dave. My story parallels yours in a way. I work for a group called Schultz Enterprises, and a 48-disc Cope-type engine was capable of lifting a tow motor, maintaining it about 700 pounds for 4.5 hours in the air. And it literally is an anti-gravity machine, you see. And out of that information, I say that there are three laws for Newton, and there's a fourth one that he would have worked on if he hadn't died, and it's called balanced imbalance for continuous in the electromagnetic field, where you have counter-rotation. It'll eliminate one of the time features in time and space. And, of course, having a toroidal-type field out of that, you have anti-gravity, whether it's micro or macro size, you see. And it does cause that so-called trifect, which is the green fog that you see in an electrical storm that caused your research to go on. And the thing is that in electrical storm, you know, of course, you have a tornado. If you were able to look up into it, you would see that you have, of course, the electrical field from the top to the bottom. But inside, you have multiple electrical flashing of electric, which gives you all the characteristics of balanced imbalance causing anti-gravity effects. And it's true for the Philadelphia experiment. It did get green fog. The thing that you need is the Tesla four coils, conical coils, that were on the deck with pulse correctly AC fields, conjugate nature, and the DC current around the peripheral of the minesweeper, and it produces that effect mathematically. In your science, you should be able to calculate that time displacement that went from Philadelphia to Norfolk in 15 minutes. And then another phenomena is that it turns the actual spin of the molecules such that you wind up with dimensional space. And that's why the sailors could walk through the bulkheads.
Yeah.
See, so the fourth rule of Newton says balanced imbalance for continuous in the electromagnetic field will produce these effects. And in addition to that, if you use scalar waves conjugated or properly structured to collapse behind you with the proper vessel dimensionally such that it will pick up the collapsing wave front, you are in L speeds, depending whatever. Now, at Schultz Enterprises, we had a, they calculated and had a construct on a Volkswagen bus, basically size, disk formation, and we should have been able to get to the moon in 4 hours.
Wow.
Our objective was only 60,000 miles an hour at the time. And that was because we were trying to stop the missiles out of Cuba, because Pittsburgh was X'd.
That's a good point. David, do you want to react to some of that? Go ahead.
Well, what actually happened with the project?
It wound up as SDI, Space Disk Invention. And it is now your, it went black off, and it's your triangles that you see flying, four, one in the middle and four in the end, and you have slip control. Advanced, and there's a good chance that I don't think it's a good idea anybody plays around with this. Now, the power is so academically, engineering-wise, the craft can be built to any power. The size of the craft can be built to any dimension just by the nature, because you eliminate a time dimension, giving you anti-gravity.
And that's what people are seeing, isn't it, George?
That is what you see, is that this empirical ship drawn through at the time of Reagan, and it's up there, and it's probably attached to the craft, spacecraft around it. Of course, it's our the full capacities of it are naturally classified, I'm sure, and it is there. And the other thing that is of interest along your line, Dave, is Keshi, who uses plasma, but counter-rotational. And Einstein, if you take a small molecule and you get it going fast as light, it will be heavier than the Earth and then some.
Yeah.
See?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I do that in a counter-rotational effect and start the speed up and get it up to the right speed by fielding, you wind up with basically two tremendous flywheels that are generating magnetic fields. And any spinning thing will cause a electrical current from the center out to the peripheral, and in proper material, if you can sustain it, create the toroidal fields. The rest is a cinch, whether you want to make... we also were going to make a continuous on battery. We could slip it into a car, and we could run wherever you want.
All right, David, let's take some more calls, but that was a great call.
Okay. Sounds good.
Mike in Montreal, welcome to the program. Mike, go ahead.
Thank you very much, George. Nice for you to have me back again. Your pain in the side that's always bugging you about your EMP efforts, which I applaud.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm the one that's always mentioning that it's not a difficult thing to take out the grid. It doesn't require a solar ejection or a terrorist nuke. It just requires a pissed-off kid that can produce a magnetic field generator.
If they can.
A magnetic pulse generator, rather. Yeah. But anyway, back to more to the topic. One of the most major scientific discoveries in our history was made recently, and there was a brief mention of it on the news, and then it disappeared. And this is really the answer to unlimited space travel, unlimited power, anything you want. And what I'm talking about, of course, is the God particle, the Higgs boson.
Yeah.
Because the Higgs boson is the particle that's responsible for the mass of an engine, or the mass of anything, is built by the Higgs boson. If you have the technology to use this, you can. The biggest problem with space travel at high speed is as you approach the speed of light, the mass of your spacecraft increases exponentially to the point where when you're approaching the speed of light, it requires enormous power to go faster. And to try and go faster than the speed of light, the barrier that stands in front of you is the mass of your ship becomes infinite, so it requires infinite power to make it go any faster, and that's because there's infinite mass. With the Higgs boson giving you the ability to eliminate mass, a spacecraft with less power than a 60-watt light bulb could easily be accelerated to the speed of light squared, the speed of light times the speed of light, because you don't have any mass to tie you down or any problems with in general, the whole problem of acceleration, it goes away. It's simple, and it's unlimited free energy. I had a second point, if you had time.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, well, just a second. I had a really unusual UFO sighting that I can't put into any pocket. I did a science fair project back in university on UFO detection, and I built a small instrument that could detect magnetic fields and, in theory, would catch a UFO going by, by my assumption that it was using some sort of magnetic field and gravitational field. I felt I could pick them off. I won the science fair and, in fact, did pick off some UFOs. And unfortunately, most of the times the clouds were overcast when I went out to see what I caught. But twice I did actually see a flying object, a light in the sky. But more interesting than that, one night, way in the middle of the night, I was walking my dog. And I just happened to look to the south, and it was pitch dark, a moonless night. I could barely see my feet walking in the dark. And all of a sudden, the southwestern sky started blinking. You know when you turn on a fluorescent light bulb, and for the first moment there's a couple of flicks, a couple of blinks, and then boom, it comes on?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, what happened here, the sky flickered just like that, flickered and then turned into intense green, and it went from horizon to horizon width, and in height it was about 30 degrees, so it was a huge, huge thing, and everything went silent, the power went off in Montreal, and I'm looking at this thing, and all of a sudden I see an object, you know, from the side it could have been a disc or a cigar shape, it's hard to say, but I see an object. And to me, because it's against the bright green, it looked sort of black, although it had a metallic sheen. But it was doing sort of a roll and a yaw and up and down. Like the nose was dipping, and then the tail would go down. And then the nose would dip, and the tail would go down. It was sort of wobbling like that. And the sound it was generating was really weird, because it sounded exactly like a World War II V1 buzz bomb. You know the sound they produced was sort of like rah, 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 until it finally ran out of power and then it would drop?
Right.
Well, it was producing that sound. And as it went by, it was dipping and up and down. It looked to me like it was going to crash, but it made it far to my left and I never saw what happened. And after about another 15 seconds, the lights blinked out.
Did David, your motor is silent, though, you said, right?
Yes, that's correct. Uh-huh. Doesn't make any noise whatsoever.
So in this particular case, what Mike had seen, he said it was making a noise. So could that be a different kind of propulsion system?
Well, some things that we have observed in the records that people have reported are plasma emanations from the craft, different colors, which we've interpreted it as being different energy levels.
Right.
Now, the interface between the exterior of a particular craft that potentially uses a plasma type of device versus what we're developing here and what I've seen on other craft being silent. But as it interacts with the air, you know, you're going to get a noise. Now, whether that translates into kind of like a pulse jet sound from a V1 buzz bomb, that kind of rattle sound that he was describing, it could be possible because as discharge and ionization of the air around the craft could have those kinds of effects. But we have seen different colors at different energy levels and different types of aerial performance, acrobatic performance, or actually abilities to move in the sky at 90-degree angles and do loops and all the kinds of other things like that, which is not representative of an aircraft or a helicopter. But unfortunately, this stuff happens at night. And again, you know, you can only report what you got. It's tough to make measurements when you have nothing to compare against, you know, depth and height of the object and things like this, because everything varies so greatly with the brightness of the light in comparison to where you are in the ground. So they're all interesting reports. It's the gleaning of the information, and unfortunately, we don't glean a whole lot.
No. Do you find that people are still a little skittish to report these?
I find in our organization here, we both at the university, we have the only MUFON university society in the country, actually in the world.
You've got it right there in Nebraska, right?
Exactly, right here in Omaha, University of Nebraska at Omaha. And we also have a paranormal society as well. I can tell you, students gravitate more to the paranormal society than they do the UFO. And there is still a stigma.
Interesting take.
It is just amazing. You know, we may have 35 students sign up in a club fair or, atmosphere in the fall and the spring, and you only have maybe one or two that will show up. And we have kind of the resident hardcore students that are members of the society. But the Paranormal Society has a bigger draft of students in there.
Sure does. David, we're going to come back and take a final hour of phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.